Let's get started. So today's speaker is going to be Taylor Hughes. So Taylor got his PhD from Stanford and after that moved to University of Illinois for a postdoc and stayed there as an assistant professor. So now he's a full professor there. So Taylor is very well known for his work on topological insulators. He co-authored some of the pioneering papers in that field, and he's generally done a lot of very important work in topological phases of matter. And so today he's going to tell us about some new developments in the field of topological insulators, in particular some connections that have recently been discovered between higher order topological insulators and fractals. So please, Taylor, you can start.
Yeah, thanks, Anton. And thanks, Anton, Tim, and Sungsik for the invitation. It's nice to be able to give these virtual talks. It's a little bit hard, I think, to judge the audience, primarily because I don't get to see the audience as well as the fact that there's people from multiple institutions. So if you've seen this talk or portions of this talk before, I apologize and won't be upset if you leave early. With that said, also, please don't feel, please feel free to interrupt me anytime to ask questions. I'm not monitoring the chat, but if you want to just interrupt, that's perfectly fine. So today's talk, as Anton mentioned, will be on electric multiple insulators. But before I begin, let me start by thanking my important collaborators. So some of the earlier work on higher order topology was done with my former student, Vladimir Benalcazar, and Andre Bernabig. And then more of the recent work has been done with some external collaborators, Easy Yo, Fiona Burnell, and then my students, Oleg and Julian. And then also there's one of the works that I'll briefly talk about where I collaborated with a local faculty member, Lucas Wagner, and his student, Will. So thanks to my collaborators. So the outline of my talk is to first sort of review any important information about classical multipole moments that you may be rusty with. And then I'll talk about how to find quantized multipole moments in crystals, at least in the scenarios I'm discussing. And then we'll show how one can calculate multipole moments. And then eventually at the end, I'll get to what I think is the most interesting piece, which is a connection between higher order topology and phases with strong dipole conservation laws, which are things like fracton systems at least in some definitions. And when I have time at the end, I'll get to those discussions. So let's begin with talking about just classical multipole moments. So you can think about these sort of classical configurations of point charges, which represent sort of canonical monopole, dipole, quadrupole, and octopole moments. These sort of things have an intrinsic dimension associated with them. For example, if you're not in at least one spatial dimension, it's hard to get a dipole. You can't separate the charges. There's sort of some intrinsic dimensionality associated to many of these things, at least for the off-diagonal moments. You can have, for example, quadrupole moments on a line, but for this talk, I'll mainly be talking about quadrupoles, which are planar. So you take two dipoles and you separate two dipoles to form a quadrupole. In our case, we want to make sure that we're talking about well-defined moments. And so there's a constraint on each of the moments for them to be independent of the global origin of coordinates. So if I calculate the dipole moment in one coordinate system, and then I change coordinate system, it turns out that the dipole moment shifts. It shifts by an amount proportional to the vector I shifted by, r, and phi, which is just the monopole moment, the charge density in this case, the total charge. The total charge. So if the system is not neutral, then the answer for what I calculate for the dipole moment will change if I change the coordinate system, which is not something we want to worry about if we're trying to associate physical observables with these things. The quadrupole moment has even further restrictions. If I shift the origin of coordinates and calculate the quadrupole moment, it shifts by a piece proportional to the total charge, as well as pieces proportional to the total dipole moment. And so if we want to have a well-defined quadrupole moment and associate sort of unambiguous physical observables to that, then we want the system to be neutral and unpolarized. And so the generic statement is that for the nth moment to be well-defined, all lower moments must vanish. And by well-defined in this case, I mean independent of the global origin of coordinates. So in each scenario, when I talk about dipole or quadrupole or octopole, I'm always imagining that only the nth moment is non-zero and all the lower moments are identically zero. So that will be a restriction I'm placing on the systems I'm studying. So again, talking about materials, we can talk about some kind of polarization, dipole moment density, which is the polarization, and it's only well-defined in some neutral materials. I can think about a neutral insulator, for example, and it can have a dipole moment per unit volume. And a physical observable associated with that is the actual surface charge. So in this case, the surface charge kind of represents the macroscopic dipole moment. The quadrupole is a little bit more subtle. I can think about the quadrupole moment density in a neutral unpolarized material. And just like the dipole moment density gives you a surface charge, the quadrupole moment density gives you a surface polarization. And so for this particular choice of the quadrupole moment QXY, and for a coordinate system where the x-axis is horizontal and the y-axis is vertical, then the a signature of this bulk quadrupole moment is a surface polarization, in this case, tangent to the surface, in this case, given by this formula on the right. And you can see sort of the polarization on the edges are kind of converging and diverging from the corners, and that's a natural place where you're going to find charges. And so what you can find is there will be corner charges where two edges intersect, where you get these sort of convergences and divergences of the polarization. You get a bound charge there. And the bound charge, again, is representative of the quadrupole moment. You get this plus minus pattern, which preserves C2 symmetry but breaks C4, which has this quadrupole moment structure, right? And in case you see me adding up different things like dipole moments with quadrupole moments and stuff like that, the moments themselves have different units, but in their intrinsic dimension, for example, dipole moment per unit per unit length in 1D or quadrupole per unit area in 2D, each multipole moment density has units of charge. So if you see me adding different things up, just be aware of the fact that the units they have depends on what dimension I'm talking about in this case. All right, so let's think about an operational definition of the quadrupole moment. So suppose I take an insulating sheet that's neutral in the bulk and unpolarized, and I want to ask a question. So we saw that a physical observable associated to the quadrupole moment is a surface polarization, right? But how are we sure that a surface polarization is a bulk property or a surface property? So let's compare those examples. So I can imagine a case where I attach the polarization only on the boundary. This would be a surface property. And I can now, for example, calculate the corner charge. And the amount of corner charge I get when I have these two surface polarizations, I can get by just integrating the charge density over that region. And you can see just by integrating that, what you'll find is that the total corner charge is just equal to the sum of the two polarizations which are entering that corner, because the bulk itself in this case is neutral and unpolarized. No charge is coming from the bulk. You only get the structure happening on the boundary, okay? If I have a bulk quadrupole moment, you can still see that you get an edge dipole moment, right? You got this minus plus dipole moment, minus plus dipole moment. But the key distinction here is that instead of both edge polarizations contributing independently to the corner charge, they both share the corner charge. And so in fact, having a bulk quadrupole moment exactly captures the failure of this equation, the fact that the corner charge is not equal to the sum of the bulk the edge polarizations. So if I add up the two edge polarizations for the bulk quadrupole moment, they overcount the corner charge in this scenario in the picture I've drawn here, because I'm adding up two dipole moments, but the corner charge is shared in that case. And so what you can do in operational definition of the quadrupole moment, for example, which is a bulk definition, which survives adding polarizations to the boundary, for example, is that I take the corner charge, subtract off the two edge polarizations, and if that's not zero, then whatever is remaining has to be due to the bulk quadrupole moment. Okay, so with that background, let's now think about these moments in periodic systems, so crystals, for example. There's already a long history of polarization, which I'm going to talk about briefly, just so we're on the same page. So suppose I have a periodic crystal. You can think about this as being, you know, you can think about either the left half of the slide being attached to the right half, or you can think about this type of pattern going on to infinity, but I'm imagining a system with perfect periodic translation symmetry. I have a set of ions. I add a set of electrons, so the system is now neutral. And I can imagine creating a polarization by dragging the electrons off the ions. And we all saw how I created this pattern by shifting the ions to the right. And so you can associate some arrow to that, right? Some definition of my dipole moment per unit cell, right? I could have gotten to the same final charge configuration by moving electrons the other way. And now, for example, we might assign a different arrow to that, right? I am now assigning the arrow to say where the electron, which unit cell the electron came from, right? So in fact, which arrow is it? In fact, this if I give you a static charge configuration, it turns out, and for a periodic system, you can't even tell me which direction the polarization is in, so it's ambiguous. So it's even worse than this. I could even drag the electron two unit cells over. And now I would associate even a longer arrow to this, right? So this is the sort of well-known ambiguity of polarization for crystals. It comes from the fact that the position operator is not well-defined for an infinite system or for a periodic system because it's not periodic. And what this means is there's an ambiguity in the polarization. And the key feature is that all of these different arrows, even despite being different, they all differ, if I subtract one another, by an integer multiple of the charge. And so in one dimension, it turns out that each of these arrows, the fractional part, the part mod integer, is the same. The only thing different is the integer part. And that the integer part just tells me which unit cell I associated the electron from when I started constructing this charge configuration. And so if I have a periodic system, you typically identify the polarization with itself, mod integer in this case. And they said this is this ambiguity, and this is not the same ambiguity as, say, shifting the origin of coordinates. These are two different things. This is the ambiguity for shifting the origin of coordinates is true for continuous non-periodic media. The one about this ambiguity here, where you have this integer quantum of polarization, is only for translation invariant systems. So the basic idea is the ambiguity is due to the choice of unit cell to which each electron was assigned in the beginning, in this case. So this ambiguity is a little bit confusing to relate. It turns out that means to relate the polarization to observable quantities. You typically only measure changes in polarization, which are charges and currents, which are honest things you can measure, unlike the polarization in a periodic system, which has this ambiguity. But we can use this ambiguity to our advantage by picking a symmetry. So let's pick a symmetry like inversion symmetry and enforce that symmetry. There's other symmetries under which the polarization is odd. Inversion, reflection, C2 rotations, charge conjugation are all symmetries in which it's odd. Let's just pick one. I'm picking inversion symmetry. So if I have that symmetry, it means that P must equal minus P. And that means that 2P equals zero. But the nice thing is the interesting thing is for a crystalline system, this equation has two solutions if we use this ambiguity. If we have this, if this equation is only true mod integer, there's actually two possible values, P equals zero and P equals E over two. And they correspond to two different physical situations. The polarization equals zero case is the scenario I've drawn here where the electron and ion sit right on top of each other. There's no polarization. That conserves, preserves inversion symmetry. But if I have a periodic system, the other situation, the other configuration which preserves inversion symmetry is when the electrons sit exactly between the ions, half a unit cell over. And now when I reflect, let's say about an ion, the electron goes back to itself up to a translation, which still preserves the inversion symmetry. And so this idea of the polarization taking these quantized non-zero values in inversion symmetric systems has been known since the late 1980s from a paper by Zach, perhaps even earlier than that, but that's the earliest paper I know of. It wasn't until later that it was sort of identified that the non-zero value for polarization could be connected to some kind of topological insulator state. So the idea is the non-zero value in this case indicates a topological insulator phase protected by the inversion symmetry in this case. So the two cases differ by this one-half polarization. So we can write down an example model, a 1D type binding model, which represents these two polarization classes. And the simplest example is the Sushi-Verhegger chain. I have a chain of, say, spinless orbitals, or let's say 2 degrees of freedom per unit cell, which I've drawn here as red and black circles. The green lines represent strong hopping tunneling terms in the system. So this is a strongly dimerized pattern. And the unit cell I've drawn is this blue dotted box. And in this case, I have a very similar system, but where the dimerization pattern is shifted over by half a unit cell. And these two cases differ by the polarization. You can see on the top line, the electron is localized within the unit cell. And the second line, the electron is localized right in between the unit cells. Remember, this green line here represents hopping, which has a ground state, which is equally weighted between the two sites in this case. And so these are sort of two cartoon limits of this model. You can take this model and then calculate the polarization using the Berry phase. So you're given the block Hamiltonian of these insulators. You calculate the Berry phase vector potential, the adiabatic connection, and you integrate that over k-space. And the Brillouin zone, and that gives you the polarization in one dimension. And heuristically, you can just think about this as this this Berry phase here is just like taking the expectation value of the position operator in the block wave function. And so it really is something like calculating the periodic part or the sort of fractional unit cell piece of the position operator. So we talked about the connection between macroscopic polarization and boundary charge. And here you can kind of see that explicitly. So if I cut these two systems by having open boundaries, then if I cut the systems at the boundaries of the slide, for example, you see that the lower case, the second case, has these unpaired states, so two states in the boundaries which lie in the insulating gap. And now, for example, in the second case, if the system is neutral, then if I have in unit cells, I have in electrons, and I fill up the valence band, but the valence band only now holds in minus one states, and the last electron I have to fill to make it neutral has to go either on the left or right side. And the left, if I choose it to be on the left or right, that picks a direction for the polarization, so you get this sort of spontaneous breaking of symmetry, which gives you a direction which picks the direction of the dipole moment in that case. And what you can show if you calculate the charge density is that if you put the electron on one side or the other side, it turns out there's an imbalance of charge. And that electron plus all the charge density coming from the filled valence band gives you an excess or deficit of exactly one half an electron charge in the boundary, which matches the change in polarization of the boundary. So these bound states at the end are not, they don't give rise to the fractional charge. They're either filled or empty. They'll give rise to one charge, but they're indicative of the fact that you get this sort of fractional charge behavior. So we can't conflate the fractional charge with the bound states, but usually in simple models, they go hand in hand. So now I want to think about taking this ideas about polarization and extending to quadrupole moments. And so how do I do that? Well, I can think about making a quadrupole by starting with two dipoles and then spreading them, separating them apart in space. And so we're going to use that basic idea to construct a model for a quantized quadrupole moment. So the expectations we have is that the quadrupole is formed from two dipoles. And so we expect we need at least two occupied bands to get that in this case. We need two dipoles. That means we sort of need two Wannier centers per unit cell, which is going to give us two occupied bands. And in order for the quadrupole moment to be well-defined, we need the polarization to be zero. And so one way to get it to be zero is to pick some symmetry which quantizes it and then to choose parameters of the model so that it's not only quantized, but quantized to be zero mod integer. And we also want to choose, if we want to quantize quadrupole moment, we also need to choose symmetries under which the quadrupole moment is odd. And so we will use the ambiguity of the quadrupole moment to quantize it. And so the symmetries I'll impose for now will be a pair of mirror symmetries. So I'm going to impose the MX mirror symmetry and the MY mirror symmetry. And I could use C4 symmetry, there's other symmetries one could use, but for now I'm just going to choose these symmetries. Okay, so let's try to now build a model. So I'm going to start now trying to construct a model with four, let's say, spinless degrees of freedom per unit cell, some kind of 4 degrees of freedom per cell. And I want to create two dipoles per unit cell. And so the simplest way to do that now is to create two SSH chains per unit cell. But these SSH chains are right on top of each other effectively. They're both inside the unit cell, so the system doesn't have a quadrupole moment yet. And so to do that, I want to try to now drag the SSH chains off the unit cell. So I want to add some hopping or tunneling between these chains in the horizontal direction. And so the first thing you write down is the case when you turn on some hopping now. So now each site now has two hopping terms, one horizontally, one vertically. And I've, in this case, chosen a single parameter to talk about all those strengths. So each hopping strength, horizontal, vertical, is given by lambda. And while this looks like a simple generalization of the SSH chain, it turns out this model has a problem. And that problem is that at half filling, this model is actually gapless. And you can see that because each plaquette, it's decoupled. Each plaquette is now like a 1D four-site type binding chain, which has energy levels of cosine of zero, cosine of plus or minus pi over two, and then cosine of pi. And it's gapless at half filling. If I put two electrons in there, it's gapless. And so actually to fix this issue, what we're going to do is we're going to put a phase shift inside each plaquette to change the boundary conditions around each plaquette. And that will effectively shift these energy levels. And the phase shift that's compatible with the mirror symmetries actually is the case when I put pi flux through each plaquette. And that will give me a minus sign in this gauge choice. And so basically I'm gonna take each of these plaquettes and multiply the one of the hoppings by a minus one. And this is the model I'm going to look at. This model is gapped at half filling. And we can, of course, turn on other parameters to tune us away from this strongly dimerized limit. I can turn on, for example, an intracell hopping term, also with pi flux. And so one can think about this as some kind of pi flux plaquette model where the intra and interunit cell hopping strengths are different in this case, right? So to see the properties of the quadrupole moment, I'm going to turn off gamma and go back to this cartoon limit and ask, do we see the macroscopic properties of the quadrupole moment, which we expect to see as surface polar, boundary polarization and corner charge. So I can cut the system. And what we see now is that in each boundary unit cell, I have this sort of dangling SSH chain, unpaired SSH chain, which exactly gives rise to a 1/2 polarization along the vertical edges. If I cut it horizontally, now you can see in this case as well, I get these dangling SSH chains, which represent these edge polarizations. And in fact, if you cut in both directions where you have two intersecting surfaces or edges, you get this unpaired mode on the corner, which is, as I said, not shouldn't be conflated, but represents the fact that in each corner unit cell, you will get a fractional charge. And so in this case, the charge you find in the corner is 1/2. And so this model here has a bulk quadrupole density of E/2. And so quadrupole density in this case is quadrupole moment divided by the area of the system. So we can see this beyond this cartoon picture, we can see this numerically, for example, just to confirm the results. So for example, now to make it slightly more away from this cartoon limit, let's turn on gamma. What you find now is a function of the ratio between the intra and inter-unit cell cases. If you cut the system in two directions, so you have corner states, you see exactly when the model is dominated by the inter-unit cell hopping, you get these low energy modes. And these modes here are fourfold degenerate, representing the four corner states in this case. And when the inter and intra-unit cell hopping are equal, it turns out you have a gap closing in the bulk. And that drives a transition to where you tune back to a trivial insulator. You can think about the gapless point as being a case where you have exactly inter and intra-unit cell hopping equal, but that's a pi flux square lattice model with one electron per unit cell, or one orbital per unit cell. And that will that gives you Dirac points, which is well known. And so that's what the transition looks like in this case. You can calculate the corner charge, and you find that in the bulk, there's a uniform density of 2 electrons per cell, except near the corners, which have this quadrupolar plus minus E/2 pattern.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
So on the previous slides, you showed that those corner states are fourfold degenerate,
mm-hmm.
right? Then yes. How do you tell which corner is occupied and which is not?
Yeah, so as always in these cases with these zero modes, even with the SSH chain, there's a choice of how you fill those four zero modes. And a typical choice that's often picked is that what you do is you pick a small symmetry breaking parameter, just like you would if you were trying to study spontaneous symmetry breaking of the Ising model, for example. And you pick a symmetry breaking parameter. In this case, I pick a case which preserves C2 symmetry, but breaks C4 symmetry. So it isolates two on the diagonals. You fill the lowest energy states, you take the system size to infinity, and then you turn off the symmetry breaking parameter. And that will fill this properly. And that's exactly how you fill the SSH chain if you want to see the non-zero polarization in that case. So it's either a symmetry breaking parameter, or you can have a choice in this case.
Okay. So always want to introduce some symmetry breaking term and then let the system to be large.
That yeah. So off. If you want to see the unambiguous quadrupolar pattern, that's the way to do it. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How is that compatible with the bulk quadrupole moment? How do I see that from a bulk unit cell?
How do you see what from a bulk unit cell?
There's some symmetry breaking, let's say. There's some quadrupole moment.
I'll talk in a minute. So if the question is, we can see the quadrupole moment from surface effects, how do we see from the bulk? Then I'll try to answer that in the upcoming slides.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Good. So for the final set of calculations one can do to test this model, one can look at the spatially resolved polarization. So for example, each of these three images here represents a plot of the Y polarization plotted along the X axis. And what you can see is in the zero correlation length limit, when the intra-unit cell hopping is off, I get exactly 1/2 polarization completely localized on the edge with no correlation length. And then as I tune the intercell hopping up, you can see that the edge polarization is still there, but now it exponentially decays into the bulk. So it's protected by the bulk gap, you can see. And if you add up all the polarization over 1/2 the system, it will still be quantized to be 1/2. And eventually, if you go past the transition to the trivial phase, when the intra-unit cell hopping dominates, there's no edge polarization at all in this case. And so these calculations confirm the sort of macroscopic properties we would expect for the boundaries of a quadrupole model. So you can extend this type of model to do octopoles, for example, in 3D. Octopoles will have surface quadrupole. It will have polarization on the lines or hinges where two surfaces meet, and you'll have corner charge. And you can construct some model with four occupied bands with pi fluxes and so forth. There's other more realistic models you could write down too, but you can extend this idea beyond quadrupole. I won't talk much about octopole in this talk, but this type of pattern or hierarchy works in higher dimensions as well. Okay, so so segueing with the previous question, we can now ask how we should calculate these multipole moments, right? So far, I've just given you a way to understand them from their surface properties, but I'd like to, you know, give you a bulk periodic system. How do I calculate this quadrupole moment, right? The quadrupole is just a product of two coordinates, x and y, so why can't we just calculate x and y and then multiply them, for example, right? The problem is that for these type of models, this is the model I wrote down, the effective electron position operators in the lattice don't commute with each other, and so you can't simultaneously diagonalize x and y and then multiply them in some sense. And so that's a challenge for this particular model. You could, for example, use this operational definition I wrote down, but this again requires you to say choose an edge termination and a corner termination and use surface properties. That's not ideal. I can't do that from the bulk. So we want to be able to diagnose these multiple points from the bulk. And so for the quantized case, when I have, for example, the two mirror symmetries, when the quadrupole moment is quantized with a symmetry, I can look for topological invariants to do this calculation for me. In non-quantized cases, which are also of interest, you have to be more creative, which we'll talk about later. So the issue here is that the topology is hidden. So when we first wrote this paper on these quadrupole moments, which is several years ago now, we had this model for many months before being able to figure out how to calculate from the bulk this the actual quadrupole moment. And the topology, it turns out, was hidden in a strange way. So one example this hidden topology is not an exact term. I'm using this as a way to describe this. So think about the quantum spin-all effect, right? So the total return number and the quantum spin-all effect is zero, but if you have a symmetry, for example, U1 spin conservation, the Z direction, for example, you can resolve the invariant further by looking at these quantum numbers. You can look, for example, at the return number of each spin component, right? This is not generic for quantum spin-all because you don't require U1 charge conservation, but there are scenarios where you have this, and then you could resolve the topology by looking at the Chern number in each spin sector, right? And so there you see that, yeah, the total number is zero if I add them up, but you can identify each one separately in this case. So in our case, it turns out we don't have a nice quantum number like spin to resolve the topology, but this idea is still kind of applicable. So the idea that came about from my student, student Vladimir, was to try to resolve the electron topology in real space, right? And the idea is we have a model with two occupied bands, and I can think about in each unit cell, I have sort of two clouds of electrons representing, you know, the electron in each band, and the wave function electron in each unit cell has some shape. But what you can do now is you can, for example, resolve the bands in real space, for example, by calculating Wannier functions. And I'll talk about this in more detail in just a moment. But this heuristic picture is quite nice. I can think about a way to, I'm going to say, resolve these electron clouds by studying their properties in real space in one spatial direction, say the x direction. And now what happens is you find for this particular quadrupole model that the two bands of electrons now completely separate in real space from each other in the x direction. And now what you can do is you can ask, are these two clouds, you have these two separate clouds or sectors, right? And you can ask, are each of these clouds topological separately, right? Each of these clouds now becomes a quasi 1D system because I've resolved it in one spatial direction. So I only have sort of one direction left. And what you can do now is you can ask, okay, let's calculate the topological invariant we know for 1D systems, which is the Berry phase. And you can show that for this particular quadrupole model, these two clouds have a pi Berry phase, quantized Berry phase of pi. And physically, that's exactly makes sense because what it means is that each of these two clouds has a dipole moment, right? The Berry phase in momentum space is related to the polarization. And what that means is that I resolve the electrons into two clouds, and each of these clouds is a dipole moment, which looks like a quadrupole, right? It's a spatially separated dipole moment, right? So it turns out you can do this, for example, in the x direction and y direction, and if they both show this quadrupolar pattern, then the model has a non-trivial quadruple moment, right? So this type of process, we call this sort of nested berry face process, and it's a little bit convoluted, but it turns out that it's one way you can identify the topology. And the idea more explicitly is as follows. I have these energy bands for my quadruple model. I take the occupied bands, and now I calculate the Wannier functions in one direction. And you do that by calculating what's called the Wilson loop operator, or the basically integral of the berry face around, around a loop in K-space. And I pick, for example, an orientation for a way to calculate this integral. And when the resulting eigenvalues of this matrix tell you what the Wannier functions are in each unit cell. And so this is a plot here of the vertical axis being distance in unit cell units. So this is one unit cell of units. And you can see for every value of kx, I have two Wannier functions in this case, since this represents the pair of bands. And what we see for this particular case is that the Wannier bands don't ever touch each other. And so in fact, if I resolve the electrons in the x direction for this particular model, you see that I get two separate sets of electrons. And you can do the same thing in the y direction. And again, you get two separate sets of electrons. And now what you can do is you can calculate the berry phase of one of these sets, or these sets independently from each other. And you find out the berry phase of a single set is pi, but both sets together is 2 pi. So again, this is a way to resolve this sort of topology by looking at these clouds of electrons, right? These Wannier bands represent the sort of electron clouds in this case. So you can do more with this. For example, you can do something in 3D where you take a system with two occupied bands and you resolve in one direction. And now instead of having 1D clouds, you have two-dimensional clouds. And now you can calculate topological invariance in 2D. So you can calculate Chern numbers or Z2 invariance, whatever you want. And it turns out if these two-dimensional clouds have a Chern number, then you get a system which has chiral states on the hinges. This is called a second-order topological insert in 3D. So if you have this procedure, you can identify the set of second order topology as well in this case. And so you can generalize this to all kinds of dimensions. You can do it for the octopole moment as well. I'll focus on that because that's not the focus now. I don't want to run short on time. But you can do things there where you resolve different electrons in different directions in real space. Okay. So that works nicely in certain cases, but not all cases, that type of procedure. So there's other symmetry classes we can use. So for example, if instead of mirror symmetry, you use C4 symmetry, then it turns out you can use symmetry indicators to determine whether or not the system has a quantized quadruple moment. Symmetry indicators being you look at the occupied wave functions and determine how they transform under, say, C4 symmetry, and those representations tell you something about the topology. What if you have a non-quantized quadrupole? Suppose we don't have C4 symmetry or mirror symmetries. We have something which, say, locks the dipole moment to be zero, but nothing which fixes the quadrupole. So there, you could always resort back to looking at surface properties, and you still need a vanishing bulk dipole moment, but that's not quite as satisfying. So how can you generically diagnose this quadrupole moment from the bulk, right, without these symmetries? And what about many-body systems? So this procedure of looking at Wannier functions is not readily generalizable to a many-body ground state, even with symmetries. And so how do we do this for these type of more generic cases? So I want to now talk about how to calculate these things for many-body systems more generically, for example. And this will lead us to the idea of what I'm calling these many-body multipole insulators. So how do you do the many-body calculation for electric polarization? Well, it turns out there's two nice ways to do that. One introduced by Ortiz and Martin in 94, another one introduced by Resta in 1999, or maybe 1998 or 99. So suppose I give you a many-body ground state. In 1D, for example, what you can do is you can twist the boundary conditions. So I can calculate the many-body ground state for a grid of boundary conditions all twisted by some phase. And then I can integrate the effectively berry phase in that space of twisted boundary conditions, and that will give me the polarization. This is an often way one can replace Brillouin zone integrals by boundary conditions. This is something that's been known since the 1980s, where people first introduced it to study the quantum Hall effect, I think, for disordered and also many body systems. And it's a sort of standard way one can replace a single body calculation of winter space with a many body calculation. There's a second way to do it, which was introduced by Resta, which is to use this many-body twist operator. So what I do now is I define a many-body position operator X, which is the sum of all single particle ones. And then basically I wrap my positions onto unit circles. So this is sort of unitarizing, making the position operator, which is Hermitian, is making it unitary effectively to make it compatible with periodic boundary conditions. And what Resta showed is that for any gapped ground state, any gapped ground state is almost an eigenstate of this operator up to corrections which vanish in the thermodynamic limit. And the eigenvalue represents the polarization. And so Resta said that you can define some complex number Zx as being the expectation value of this, and the polarization is related to the imaginary part of the log of this number. And so these are both ways one can calculate the polarization in a many-body more generic context. Disorder systems, it works. Many-body systems, it works, so it's more generic. So what about the quadrupole moment? So suppose we're in 2D and we're given some ground state. What about the Berry phase? There's no obvious Berry phase way to do this. I'll come back to this later, but there's no simple way we could think of to sort of twist boundary conditions. I'll show a way to do this later, but based on what we currently introduced, there's not a simple way to come back to this, because the Berry phase formalism I introduced requires you to calculate the Berry phase of a Wannier function band, which is not obvious how to generalize that to many-body systems. But one can take the second approach of defining some many-body twist operator use of XY. And so one can calculate this for the quadrupole moment, and you can do a same similar definition. You can sort of follow the what REST has set forth and try to calculate this. And it turns out that it works. So what you can do, this is a numerical comparison of the quadrupole moment, which are the blue dots, which are captured by this many-body calculation. And it's compared with the edge polarization and corner charge, which for this model should all match, all be the same value. And it's tuned with a parameter theta, where I have a model which I can tune the quadrupole moment continuously from 0 to 1/2. And you can see that this sort of calculation where I have a pumping process where the quadrupole is changing, all these results lie right on top of each other. But there's a problem. And the problem is that it turns out that this nice result that Resta has, that any many-body ground state is almost an eigenstate and becomes an eigenstate in the thermodynamic limit. What that means is that the magnitude of this expectation value goes to 1 in the thermodynamic limit. So it's well-defined in the thermodynamic limit. It turns out if you naively calculate the expectation value of any ground, some generic ground state in this case, it turns out that the expectation value of the operator we defined goes to 0 in the thermodynamic limit. So in fact, if we use bigger size numerics, it turns out that it would be harder and harder to take the log of the number, because the magnitude of the expectation value would be going to 0. So as soon as the magnitude got to 10 to the minus 16, we would be out of luck trying to calculate this, right? So it turns out that the phase, the quadrupole moment, is sort of seemingly not well-defined in the thermodynamic limit. So what's going on here, right? So this leads us nicely to a second piece of information, which is that it turns out that the way that this expectation value approaches 1 in the thermodynamic limit has a physical interpretation. It turns out that one can relate the magnitude of this value to the charge localization length. And this is the standard charge localization length. It could be disorder system, many-body system. It represents the sort of average spread of the electrons in this case. And so it turns out that this value goes to 1 in the thermodynamic limit. And in fact, if for finite size, the magnitude of this operator is only equal, expectation value is only equal to 1 if the charge localization length exactly vanishes. So what that means is that many-body ground states are only exact eigenstates of this operator if this charge localization length is exactly 0. We'll get back to that in a minute. So there's a really beautiful result that was sort of come upon by several groups in the late 1990s, which relates this charge localization link to the fluctuations of the dipole moment, how easily dipole moment can sort of slosh around in your system. And this dipole fluctuation is exactly related to the fact that the ground states are not eigenstates of the dipole operator, right? That's obvious. So if my system's not, if my ground state is not an eigenstate of the polarization, that means the polarization has some distribution, it has some fluctuations. And so it led to a really beautiful criterion where by fluctuation dissipation theorem, it turns out you can relate dipole fluctuations to the XX conductivity. And this led these three groups to sort of propose a criterion that if the charge localization length is infinity in the thermodynamic limit, it's a metal. In a generic scenario, many-body disorder, what have you. And if it goes to a constant thermodynamic limit, it's an insulator. And so all these criteria are based on the magnitude of this operator. But what this shows is that if I give you a generic gap ground state, even one where the polarization is zero, so even one where the eigenvalue P is zero, mod integer in this case, it turns out that the fluctuations of the dipole moment are not zero generically. And that means that the calculations of the quadrupole moment are called into question because the quadrupole moment requires a vanishing dipole moment, right? And if the dipole moment's fluctuating in different configurations, if there's a distribution, right, if it's not always zero, it's only zero on average, then calculating the quadrupole moment has a problem. And this is exactly the problem we have here, which is that if I want to understand how to calculate the quadrupole moment, I need to start with a system where the polarization is exactly zero, not sort of zero on average. And so this is one of the issues with the formulation that I wrote down. So what that means is that if I want to apply this operator, I want to study systems where there's no fluctuations of the dipole moment, right? So I'm not going to go back and try to resolve how to, you know, deal with finite size numerics. What I want to do is now I say, okay, well, let's take, when is this operator actually well-defined? It's only well-defined when C is exactly zero, when ground states are exact eigenstates of the dipole operator, right? So what systems have this property? Well, for free fermion systems, band systems, for example, it turns out for this to be true, the Wannier functions must be exact delta functions, not even SSH chain localized, but exact delta functions. And this is too restrictive to study interesting systems, okay? But if you study, you can think about many body systems where in order for this to be zero, you just need to have dipole conservation, right? So charge and dipole conservation. So what does that mean? So for charge conservation, right? I'm talking about global charge conservation. I gave you some operators and, you know, I multiply them by the phase factors. And if I have an equal number of daggers and non-daggers, then these type of operator strings are invariant under charge, global charge U1 transformation. So a dipole transformation means I can rotate the phase by a linear function of the coordinates, not an arbitrary function like for a local gauge transformation, but a linear function of the coordinates. And now, for example, you can see that quartic terms like this, for example, where I have, this is a quartic ring exchange term. You can show, for example, that terms like this are invariant in preserved dipole, but hopping terms don't. If I have a hopping term between two sites, which are different sites, they don't have dipole conservation generically in this case. And so it turns out that, just as I mentioned, if you want a system which preserves dipole moment, you need to look for a many-body interacting system in this case, for a generic case. So I'm going to focus now on these type of many-body systems where C is exactly zero. The first consequence of having no fluctuations of the dipole moment means that ground states are exact eigenstates of these positional twist operators with eigenvalue equal to 2 pi I times polarization. The second thing it means is that if I have a conserved dipole, U1 dipole, I can couple the system to a rank two, what's called a rank two gauge field, right? So if you're not familiar with what these rank two gauge fields are, they're basically symmetric tensor gauge fields. But in a lattice sense, you can think about it as like a generalized Pyrrhos factor, right? A typical Pyrrhos factor, you multiply C dagger C times E to the IA, right? You add a Wilson loop to C dagger C to make it gauge invariant if you couple to a gauge field. What I'm saying here is that if the generic terms of my Hamiltonian are not hopping terms, but are ring exchange terms, those terms naturally couple to a Pyrrhos factor. And that Pyrrhos factor represents a rank two symmetric gauge field in this case. In this case, the off-diagonal components, AXY. So you can just think about it as a sort of a generalized Pyrrhos factor for ring exchange terms that is well-defined as long as I don't have any usual Pyrrhos factors with the regular gauge potential in it. And so heuristically, what that means is that this rank two gauge potential, heuristically, not identically, but heuristically, you can think about it as sort of being like the gradient of the ordinary vector potential in this case. And what you can think about is that if the system is conserves dipole, then it's not sensitive to electric fields. It's only sensitive to gradients of electric fields, right? Because if I apply electric field, if the dipole is conserved, the system doesn't polarize, right? The dipole has to be fixed. And so it's not sensitive to an electric field, only to gradients of electric field. And this is where this sort of heuristic understanding comes from. Okay, so now what I want to do is that now that I have some way to think about systems where the dipole moment is conserved, I want to now just follow the results of Resta and others to think about a criterion to distinguish systems which can insulate dipoles or conduct dipoles, right? So one thing I can do is I can generalize Cohn's criterion for insulators, right? Cohn's criterion for insulators was that the system is insensitive two twisted boundary conditions. And now instead of twisting the ordinary gauge potential, I can twist this rank two vector potential. And I can ask, is the ground state energy sensitive to this twist? And I can ask, I can define a dipole stiffness, which is the second derivative of the ground state energy with respect to twisting the boundary conditions by this rank two thing. That gives me a way to identify a dipole Drude weight, which can distinguish metals from insulators. But I can also now use this many-body operator I defined, the quadrupole operator, to define a dipole localization area. So I can use the same criterion to think about this, where this gives me basically the fluctuations of the quadrupole moment. Instead of fluctuations of the dipole, which are zero in these cases, I can think about fluctuations of the quadrupole moment. That's related to a conductivity of dipoles instead of a conductivity of charges. And I can then have a criterion which leads me to a dipole insulator or a dipole metal. And both of these systems are, these are all charge insulators, right? The charge is it's a neutral system. I need to have the charge localization length be zero, which means the conductivity is zero. And so these are charge insulators. And what I'm saying is if a charged insulator conserves dipoles, I now have a way to distinguish a class of charge insulators, which either conduct dipoles or insulate dipoles in this case. So we can also now use this idea to define a rank two Berry phase. And so for ground states obeying the property that the polarization vanishes, you can now act on the ground state with this operator and you get a phase factor back. And in cases where dipole is conserved, you can now prove Resta's result, like something, an analogous result to Resta's result, which shows that now for ground states with vanishing charge localization length, they are almost exact eigenstates of this quadrupole operator up to thermodynamic limit corrections, the corrections that go with the thermodynamic limit, and the phase is equal to the quadrupole moment. And so now what it does is it gives you a way to now define a Berry phase way to calculate the quadrupole moment. You take the system and you basically twist the boundary conditions by this rank two phase factor, and the Berry phase integral of this rank two phase factor gives you the quadrupole moment. So it turns out this is a way to generalize the sort of typical twisted boundary conditions now to looking at higher rank gauge fields in this case. And this type of thing, as I mentioned, gives you the quadrupole moment. So there's a nice work by Hatsugai's group, which talks about a way to, a related way to look at Berry phases by twisting around certain plaquettes. I'm not going to discuss that in detail, but there may be some connection with this formalism and their formalism. And let's give an example model to show how all these things work, right? So I've sort of given some generic formalism. I want to think about a model now where I have inter and intracell ring exchange. There's no quadratic terms in the Hamiltonian. Everything in this Hamiltonian is a quartic interaction term, right? What that means is that it's hard to solve. In fact, if both T and lambda, which are the intra and intercell ring exchange terms, if they're both on, I cannot exactly solve it. I can solve it in two limits, right? The limit when lambda dominates and it's very large, and the limit when T dominates, right? And so if I let T equal zero, now I only have intercell ring exchange terms. I can calculate the ground state, which is now just a sum over these two different ring exchange configurations. And I have basically a bunch of cluster states. What you can show is that this model has a finite dipole localization area. And so this model is a charge insulator. It's also a dipole insulator by our criterion. It has a dipole gap, basically it insulates dipoles. And furthermore, what you can show is that if you twist the boundary conditions by this rank two phase, if I add a rank two Pyrrhus factor to these ring exchange terms, what you find is that the ground state, each ground state cluster gets multiplied by a phase factor proportional to e to the I times this twist Q. And now what you can do is you can calculate the Berry phase. And what you show is that for this model, when lambda is finite and T is zero, this model has a pi rank two Berry phase. And that means this model has a quadrupole moment in this case. And so you can see that because this model, right, has a very similar structure to the hopping model we looked at. Except but now of having a set of four hopping terms, we have one quartic ring exchange term. And so the phenomenology of this model is quite similar in this case. And it will have for example, a fractional corner charge of 1/2, just like the tight binding model we wrote down had in this case. And in fact, if you're careful, what you can show is that the ground state of this model is adiabatically connected to the ground state of the free fermion model. You can adjust parameters to show numerically that they go over from one to the other in this case. So it turns out this model has two phases. If I now let lambda be zero and only have T on in this case, then it turns out that the rank two Berry phase of the model when T dominates is trivial because everything now is happening inside the unit cell. There's no sensitivity to this boundary condition twist in this case. Okay, so let me see. Let me check the, try to see what time it is here. Okay, so we have about a few minutes left. Okay, maybe I'll briefly say this.
Can I interrupt?
Yes, sure.
Good question. So in the previous type bind model, you didn't have the exact dipole moment conservation, right?
That's right, I do not, that's right, yeah.
Whereas this one has.
Yeah, yeah. So the difference is as follows, right? This is a great question. So in the type binding case, in the ground state, right, the system has a fixed dipole moment of zero, right? It's zero in that case, right? But if I have excitations upon the ground state, right, they will be particle hole excitations, which violate dipole conservation, right? So the excitations of that Hamiltonian don't conserve dipole moment. The excitations of this Hamiltonian do conserve dipole moment. So this model doesn't have a microscopic, so the type binding model does not have a microscopic dipole conservation law, but it probably has something emergent in the ground state where there's effectively a fixed dipole moment. And so the quadrupole moment is still well defined in that scenario.
Oh, I see.
Okay. So what I'm saying is heuristically probably true, but it hasn't been proven. So this is actually an important open question, is about the real connection, but say between models which have like a low energy conservation versus ones that don't, like, you know, in this case, right? So this model, all excitations happen in quartets, so everything conserves dipole, even the excitations do. In the other model, they don't, right? And so it's an interesting open question about how important it is to have this microscopic conservation law or how to get it emergently, for example, I think is a good open question.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So, So what I want to say is that beyond microscopics, one can think about the response theories in this case. So if I can make an analogy between the response, the polarization response of a 1D topological charge insulator, which has this polarization response, which is this theta term action, the Goldstone-Wolchek response. And if it's not familiar to you, in this case, all we're saying here is that if this 1D topological charge insulator, if you couple it to a vector potential and to a theta field, you can integrate out the gapped fermions and you find this action, which ends up being just basically polarization dot electric field that would appear in the action. And you can work out the charge densities, the gradient of polarization, which we knew. And the current is the time derivative of polarization. And so you can identify the polarization of the system as this theta axion angle divided by 2 pi. You can do something similar for the 2D dipole insulator, which is that you can have a rank 2 theta field action in 2 plus 1 dimensions, where the electric field in this case is the rank 2 electric field. It's a gauge invariant combination of the scalar potential and the rank 2 vector potential. And you can work out, you find that the charge density is the double derivative of the theta field, which is like finding charge where you have a corner, right? Where you have an X derivative or an X derivative and a Y derivative meet at a corner. And the dipole current now, JXY, is the time derivative of theta. And you can identify theta as this value. And you can show for the model wrote down that theta is quantized to be zero or pi by symmetry in this case. And so you can think about this model as being sort of a two-dimensional dipole insulator, similar to like an SSH chain being a 1D topological charge insulator because of this action. And it turns out that you can now think about breaking the U1 dipole symmetry, but keeping a spatial symmetry. So for example, I have talked about in the last few minutes having a system with an exact dipole conservation, right? But what you can do is you can imagine a scenario where you break the dipole conservation, but you keep some spatial symmetry so the total polarization remains zero. So then what happens is this rank two structure breaks down, and now you're left with only where the rank two structure now is only determined by gradients of the electric field. And you can see that's exactly what would couple to the quadrupole moment. The quadrupole moment QXY couples exactly to a gradient of electric field like this. And so it turns out that what you can do in this scenario is that if you keep if you break the dipole conservation but keep a spatial symmetry, you can, as I mentioned before, you can adiabatically connect one model to the other model. And so it shows there's some connection between this idea of a dipole conserving system, which are like fracton models, and a higher order system, which has spatial symmetry. So in one case, you have this sort of microscopic conservation. And the other case, you sort of have a symmetry protected ground state property in this case. And you can show that the ground states of one can be mapped onto the other. You can show that numerically at least. Although the excitations, of course, will be quite different because of the conservation laws in this case. So basically, if you now take this effective action that you have for dipole conserving things and you replace EXY with the gradient electric field, you recover exactly what you'd expect to find, where you have a quadrupole moment dotted into the gradient electric field being the effective response action of this 2D higher order topological insulator. Okay, so as a summary, what we did here in the last sort of half of the talk is try to propose a refinement of charged insulators if you have additional conservation laws. So at zeroth order, I either have a metal or an insulator for charges. If I have a charge insulator, I can ask, does it conserve dipoles? And if it conserves dipoles, I can now think about it either being a dipole metal or dipole insulator. And if I take a dipole insulator and ask, does it conserve quadrupoles? I can now go about asking if it's a quadrupole metal or quadrupole insulator, you can sort of have this hierarchy of multiple insulators distinguished by whether they conduct or insulate the various types of multiple moments, right? And this idea is kind of similar to the idea of, let's say there's a lot of, for example, you can study 1D Bose-Nye systems, which have both charge and spin excitations. And for example, maybe the charge excitations are gapped, but the spin excitations are gapless, right? Or you can have a charge gap and a spin gap, right? There's a very similar, I think, analogy between that type of idea and an idea here, where maybe you have a charge gap, but you don't have a dipole gap, for example, or maybe you have a dipole gap, but not a quadrupole gap. And so there's these different scenarios where these different multiple moments, if they're conserved, can have low energy excitations or not. Okay, so I'll stop there and take any questions, and then I'm happy to answer anything.
So thank you, Taylor, for a very nice talk. So are there any questions?
Can I ask a question? This is Yong Baek.
Hey, yeah, sure.
When you talk about this rank two Bailey space formulation, maybe you already explained, but are you assuming that the rank one Bailey phase is always zero or one out?
Yeah, so it turns out if I'm allowed to couple my model to rank one Berry phase, then then the rank two Berry phase doesn't make sense, right? So for example, for this ring exchange model here, right, the sort of lowest order pyrrhos factor I could add is like a term multiplying this ring exchange term. Mm-hmm. If I have hopping terms, then I can add pyrrhos factors to those. But what that does is it means that the rank two factor is just gradients of the rank one factor, right? So there's not this sort of independent structure.
I see. In
that case. Mm-hmm. So the idea of conserving dipole means that the system just doesn't couple to electric fields. It doesn't couple to the sort of uniform rank one electric fields in some sense, mm-hmm. right? If it does, then the system can be polarized and the dipole is not conserved, right? So think about it this way, right? If I have a system which conserves dipole and I apply an electric field to it, then it can't polarize like a normal insulator would, because if it polarizes, the dipole moment is changing, right? So it sort of has to have no leading order response to the rank one electric field in this case.
So related question is, what about like having dipole non-conserving excitations in the system, but imagine the density of state of such excitation is very small. So there's some pseudo gap with, you know, some power law density of state of those. So if the density of state of those excitations are sufficiently small, do you think that this may still work?
I think this is related to Sunset's question as well. So the question of how to find this type of system in a solid state realization is difficult, I think, right? Same thing with finding these exact conservation laws for fracton systems, right? Because they kind of, you know, in spin systems maybe, but in electronic solid state, I think it's harder, right? So my hope is that, as you said, there's some limits you can take, or some scenarios where the violations are limited enough where you can get emergent dipole conservation effectively, right? In some sense, right? But it's a great open question. Yeah, I don't have an answer for that. And I mean, it would be nice if one could find a model context where you could study it carefully. I think that's a difficult thing, because the typical models you're dealing with now almost all require interactions to do something interesting. So mm-hmm. It's hard to address that. We have some studies of this model, for example. So I mentioned for the model that's on the screen now that we studied it in the lambda equals zero limit, t equals zero limit. We also studied it with Frank Pullman's group and with EZ and his and Frank Pullman's student. We studied it in DMRG as a function of both parameters. You can show there's a transition between the two dipole insulating phases, which is dipole metal. But I think finding the good model context to study that question is really important. Yeah.
Thank you.
So Tarun has his hand raised. Yeah, Tarun, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, very nice talk. I had a very nice question about, so if I consider the dipole operator, define the U operator, e to the power I, sum of positions, mm-hmm. That has a interesting commutation with translation, which leads to Luttinger theorem for the Fermi surface, as shown by Masaki Yoshikawa. Mm-hmm. So if I now take your the quadrupolar operator, the e to the power I x y kind of object, does it also lead to some version of Luttinger theorem for maybe some kind of dipole metal or something like that?
Right. Yeah, it does. Yeah. So the I think there's two related papers in this. One is from my group, and one is EZ and her collaborators at Princeton, I believe. So the idea there is that to find a dipole insulator, you require it to be integer filling for charge and integer dipole filling. Basically, the dipole means the dipole moment has to be zero up to mod. It's up to its quantum in this case. Yeah. So you get some condition like that, and So there are ways, as you said. So that's a great natural place to apply this type of operator. So if you have dipole conservation, you can then apply this operator, basically following Masaki's arguments, and write down some kind of conditions for the system to be a dipole insulator based on filling of dipoles and filling of charges in this case. Yeah.
I see. So a follow-up question would then be that, are there analogs of fractionalized Fermi liquids, FL star, which violate this generalized, this new Luttinger theorem, which maybe not be as easy detectable? Are there cases which are not maybe electrical, if I think about in terms of charge, maybe the quantization is not so, I mean, maybe not violated in charge, but violated in the Luttinger theorem for dipole is, the quadrupole is violated, but not.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. So I would say that all signs point to, yes, there should be examples of that. I don't have one off the top of my head, but I think that's a good open question to look at. Yeah, that would be a really nice thing, especially if one can find an example model. And, these models with these strong conservation laws, are connected to at least the idea of these fractonic models. So there's probably some places there where one could look for models like that, like you're describing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So I actually have a question myself. So is there any connection here to these, Bose metal phases that people have explored in this sort of ring exchange models, many years ago?
Yeah, it's a great question. So so the answer to that is yes. It seems so I can say this because of the numerics that in this paper I mentioned. What we looked at is a transition between these two different dipole insulating phases. So essentially the idea is that a dipole metal is analogous to this this sort of Bose metal phase, and the type of Bose metal we have in this case is one that has a dispersion relation, which is like omega equals kx times ky. It has this sort of quadratic off diagonal dispersion relation. And so numerically, we're able to show that the transition between, as a function of, say, lambda and t, or lambda and some other intracell coupling term, gives you this critical point, which seems to realize that type of two-dimensional Bose metal. There's been a lot of work where people have studied ring exchange terms which don't have this dimerization pattern. A lot of the models you're mentioning, like Motronich, others, lots of people have studied these models where you have the ring exchange intra and intercell are sort of competing with each other on the same scale, or you have a bunch of linear combinations of non-dimerized things, right, in this case. So I think that there is a direct connection between the older work and the stuff that we have done. We're aware of a lot of it, and I think that one could talk about a dipole. I don't know if it's always true, but there are certainly some scenarios where dipole metals and this Bose metal thing are exactly the same. The exotonic Bose liquid is the same, or at least have the same physical properties.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah.
So, any other questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Taylor for a very, very nice talk. And well, so we will see you all next week.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me again. Thank you.